In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, this is Ryan Fraser.
This is Troy Daly.
This is Gus Boyett.
This is Don Hutchison.
This is Jürgen Klopp, and you're listening to The Big Interview with Graham Hunter.
Thank you, Jürgen. I travel to all these interviews from Barcelona, and our socios, our beloved members, keep us on the road. This independent podcast wouldn't happen without them. Please go to patreon.com/Graham Hunter right now to join us, to become a socio, and to get every interview we produce without adverts and before it goes out on the main feed, plus lots of bonus content, including the chance to put questions to our guests and to me via the monthly Q&A. So do please go to patreon.com/Graham Hunter and join the club and get your family and friends to do so. Maybe even strangers in the street. Love you.
Welcome back to The Big Interview. You know already that I'm Graham Hunter. We wanted to have Brad Friedel on our series because he's bright, he's interesting, he's distinctive, he was an extremely good goalkeeper, and we were all intrigued by the mystery of how is it feasible not to play until late in age, but to play and get better every year. Across this two-part interview, because Brad was very generous with his time, speaking to us from a lovely clapperboard house in Massachusetts, not where he lives now, but he is based back home in the States. We would cover things like what it's actually like to be an Ohioan, and related to bootleggers. You don't know what bootleggers are? Listen and you'll find out. It's brilliant. Across the piece, we're going to be speaking about life in England, adapting to what it's like as an outsider to make your way as a culturally curious man, a curiosity which Brad also assuaged playing in Turkey. There are some fabulous stories about his time with Graham Souness for Galatasaray. Coming down the line, so enjoy this and come back, please. You won't have heard a better description from a goalkeeper about what it's like to lose a goal against a man who you know everything he's going to do, but still the ball goes past you. This is Brad Friedel on The Big Interview. It's an absolute corker. The ever-growing paper trail that is the joyful series Big Interview. Listeners, welcome back. We've got a treat today because I'm sitting looking at one of the great US sportsmen of all time. Sportsmen, not just soccer players of all time. I'm sitting looking at a guy of smart brains and big character, and we're about to spend an extended period of time in his company, Brad Friedel. Welcome to The Big Interview. Thank you for making time in your Massachusetts timetable. I think we've just established. Have I got the right state for you?
Yeah, I'm in Boston right now. I currently live in Miami, but I'm up in Boston today doing this.
But you wish you were in North London or in Birmingham or maybe down by the Mersey or...
Actually, North London, yeah. I love the UK. Anywhere in the UK, to be honest with you.
Well, it's a starting place, Brad, because... You've been well briefed. One, thank you. But you've been well briefed about the fact that this might seem idiosyncratic or even eccentric at times. But When I was growing up in Aberdeen, which is in the cold northeast of Scotland, there was a program on television called Minder. And it was I don't know if you've ever seen it or whatever, but it was a guy who was a minder for a kind of, not crooked, but edge-of-the-law businessman. It was deeply funny, and it was based in 1970s London, and it was the follow-up to a programme called The Sweeney, which was about the flying squad in London in the 70s. And it was raucous, and it was full of London wit, but it was full of accents, and it was full of London locations. And sitting there as a teenager, I have no embarrassment at saying that my goal to move to live and work in London, which I did eventually and spent 5-6 years there before moving to Barcelona 20 years ago, was I have to relive Minder. I have to hear those accents. I have to hear those white boys. And I want to put you back to the 9-year-old Brad, because I'm going to ask you and talk to you at more length about your upbringing in a minute. But 9-year-old Brad Friedel finds himself on, I quote, a rickety London Underground train heading to Wembley, and you detail what you find there for the first time, and you're living a Minder script, because there's geezers, there's beer, there's noise, you get to the stadium, it's your tale, you'll tell it, but there's a little bit of violence, there's cops charging around. Will you, because I think it's a central part of the theme of you realising dreams in your life, will you take us back to what was 9-year-old Brad doing in London, and paint your own picture of what it was like that day?
I was on just a family vacation around Europe with my mom, my dad, and my sister, and I believe at times my mom's mom and dad, you know, joined us in various cities, and I grew up playing every sport, but I really loved football. You know, ice hockey and football were my two loves, and not American football. We're proper football, and my dad. I don't know how he got tickets, but he got tickets to the Charity Shield. I think it was the Charity Shield. It was Liverpool against West Ham, I believe, and that was the day that I became a Liverpool supporter. That's, you know, because growing up in Cleveland, We had a little bit of Liverpool on TV, and we had a bit of Bayern Munich on TV, but you know, once a week type of stuff. Those two very successful clubs, obviously, at the time, but not a lot, you know. So there, you know, I had to wait, you know, to get my Soccer Digest once a month, kind of thing. You know, it was one of those times, you know, you're aware. You know, the Soccer Digest is 3 days. It's going to come, and then you could go through all the monthly results, and that you just didn't have a lot of a paper trail. No computers, obviously, in the house. It wasn't Google. We didn't have, you know, you couldn't get results readily. So, anyways, we roll up to the game. My dad tells me, you know, I'm going to take you to a game. Okay, you know, I'd been to Cleveland Browns games. I've been to Cleveland Indians games. I've been to Cleveland Cavaliers games. Figured it's going to be similar. No way, man. It's the old Wembley, and it is manic. I mean, you know, that the horses were enormous. I was only a young boy at the time. The horses were enormous, and not too many times in the States had I seen police men and women on horses, you know, and like looking around, and the fans and the singing. We don't have that in the United States. You know, you don't, every now and again, there's a chant and a big roar, but like on the way outside stadiums into the grounds, you don't have droves of supporters and different supporters sections and coming from various areas of the globe and the country all together and coming in and singing their own songs. And it was just mesmerizing. There really was. And I look around, but I tell my dad, I mean, in the midst of all this chaos, I tell my dad, like, I gotta go to the toilet. We wait in the queue, and I mean, and you're back then, you know, that the and plus the drinking culture in the UK, just in general, you know, there's a lot of police presence, but you know, most everyone there was pissed. We go in there, and somehow, some way, which I know shouldn't have happened, there's West Ham supporters and Liverpool supporters in the loo at the time. And not many, but there was one or two, and I can't remember who did what on who, but one urinated on another in the stall, like not far from me, and a fight broke out. and the police come charging in, and my dad, and I had finished, my dad like swoops me up, you know, and I could see in his face, he's contemplating, do we stay or do we go? We obviously stayed, and it was remarkable. I think the thing that I take away from it the most is the, and I'll just use the word culture. The culture over in the United States is more of a, I'm buying my ticket, and now you, and when I say you, the whole club, players, the club, whether the cheerleaders, the band, whatever, entertain me now. That's the American mentality. I'll cheer for you when you entertain me. Whereas there, the game hadn't even kicked off, and the culture is to back and support your club, no matter what. And even in the down times, when fans are disgruntled and upset, there's still a great atmosphere around. It might be a little bit of a negative atmosphere, but it's still an atmosphere, and they want what's best for the club, and they want to win. So it was such a difference, and I loved it. I loved every minute of it, and it's probably why I love football so much, because in American sports, which I like as well, don't get me wrong, I'm not like bashing American sports, but it's a lot stop, start, and coaches get together and give you a play, and you go and do it again. Whereas football, you have a system, you have a style, but so many things happen in a game. It's far more fluid, and you can't call a timeout and say, hey, do this. You know, every now and again, you get instruction, but, you know, you got to figure it out on your own. And I like that about it on both sides.
From 9 until now, whatever you are, 39, just turning 40, what have you been able to deduce about that British culture that you witnessed then and you fueled as a really beloved player? Because it feels to me some of our tribalism, once the club's in there, it's in there for life, as if it was a stamp on your heart forever. And the singing on the way to the games, it feels to me part of our, I don't know if it's a part of our military culture in Britain. I don't know if it's part of the class structure in Britain, where those who maybe don't, across the years, not just across your life, those who don't have much need something to elevate their lives, and therefore they'll commit to it and sing about it and look at it like a battle. How have you worked out why we're like what we're like?
I put it more down to allegiances in a sense, where, and this is something that I love the most about living in the UK and in England, not playing football, but living. Every little community that I lived in, it's like the pub culture. I don't mean going and getting pissed culture. I tell my American friends this. If you're ever in England, if you're ever like locked out of your home or you need help with something or whatever, you can walk down to your local pub, see 100 friendly faces, and almost every single one of them would drop everything to help you out with what you need at the time. And why? Well, because I lived in Thaden Boys, and that's what people in Thaden Boys do for people in Thaden Boys. Like, it's like that. Now, would they help someone that was in a town over? I don't know. Maybe not. You know, but if you're there, I think these allegiances form. And I don't know if you go back, in time, if it had to do with the class system. It could have. It absolutely could. But like, once you're a Tottenham supporter, you're a Tottenham supporter. If you're a West Ham supporter, you're a West Ham supporter. And you might live right here and right here, but, you know, right next to each other. But that's it. And if West Ham relegates, they relegate, and you're still a West Ham supporter. If they go down to League One, you're still a West Ham supporter. You know, you still have the tattoo. You'll still have it in your blood. You know, that's it. Look at Man City's history, and that just name that, just because I was living in Manchester at the time that they were doing the up down 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 down, and then boom, here we are today. It will and most of the Man City supporters when I lived in Manchester were local because of where the club was at, Man United, was this global steam train rolling everywhere. People flew in from everywhere. Generally speaking, Man City was the locals. Yeah, and I just think all these like allegiances form. I got the sense, especially in the north of England, there weren't a lot of travelers. And I don't mean traveling to a away game. I just mean in their life. You know, Spain every now and again, Portugal every now and again. Real homebodies. Like they like waking up and having their cup of tea. They like going and doing the bulls. They like having their, you know, they get set in a life, you know, and where, wait, it's 5 o'clock. I got to be at the pub. You know, they didn't really go branch out too much. London, completely different. Now, I lived outside of London in Essex, but in Thaden Boys, as I had said, and just Thaden Boys had a very, not the mentality of the people, but the area had a very northern feel to it, with the way that it was set up and the pubs and the miniature Tesco and the small little areas were, but and everyone sort of knew everybody. But the cosmopolitan nature of London is outstanding. I got to say, it's my favorite city on the planet. It was magnificent just with everything it had to offer while also being able to live in the countryside.
Well, it's a stunning place that I enjoyed and I miss to this day. And I particularly miss the Thames, which just enchants me. And part of the message of this podcast is going to be to Antonio Conte and to Daniel Levy to get you back where you belong. But I need to turn that cultural analysis on its head. And if you'll tolerate me, because it's only if this interests you, but it does interest me. Two things about where you grow up, which predominantly I think is Bay Village. But what over your life, because you're a very cosmopolitan, multicultural man, what over your life has being an Ohioan done for you? What did it teach you? What has stayed with you about being an Ohioan? And I need also to know if Lake Erie has had a big influence on you, simply because I'm obsessed by bodies of water. I have to live near the sea or a river. I cannot, will not ever live in a landlocked place. And the pool, the way that lochs, lakes, the sea, big rivers pool me, the relationship wolves are supposed to have with the moon, that's me and water. Those are my two questions, being an Ohioan and Lake Erie.
All right, let's do Lake Erie first, because that's a shorter response. But I also like living on the water, near water. Lake Erie is like an ocean. You know, the Great Lakes are enormous. So, you know, if I was down in Florida visiting my grandparents growing up in Naples, and I looked out at, they lived over on the west coast of Florida. So if I'm looking over at the Gulf of Mexico, it looked the exact same as Lake Erie, not the beach. So don't, you know, the listener, don't say the beach is the same. That's not true. But the water looked the exact same. The city of Cleveland, if you go back, it has history of prohibition to it. It's a steel industry, steel town. The mafia set up shop at Terminal Tower. Very safe place back then because it was mafia run. A little anecdote: Elliot Ness from the film Untouchables. He lived in Bay Village for a short time because it's not far from where he probably had to try to stop a few people in Cleveland.
Because Lake Erie was a place you could run. The prohibition, for those who don't remember, is when America somehow banned all alcohol, but bootleg alcohol would have come across Lake Erie
from Canada, correct. And they could have brought it in, and when they did, they brought it in droves. And I guess I'm glad I answered that part of the question first with Lake Erie, because Cleveland's not a soft town to live in. I would equate it to Newcastle. There's four seasons, and two of them are really nice weather, and two of them are brutal. You know, like minus 30 degree days and the snow. You know, I remember. I grew up in the great, I think, blizzard of 1978, you know, where the snow was above the rooftop of a two-story home. You know, if you Google photos, it's remarkable. Just another little anecdote. When I trained when I was at Blackburn and the weather was atrocious, I usually had a short sleeve shirt on, wear one of those Under Armour things underneath just so I didn't cut up my arms. But people used to look at me and say, Brad, you're mental. And no, I come from Cleveland. Like, this is nothing compared to the cold of Cleveland, you know. And so Bay Village is softer than Cleveland, but I grew up in sports and you play everywhere and it's a hard town. So when I was growing up and you just get to the age to go to the bars and play pool and all that, usually a fight every night. I never really minded being around it. You get your wits about you a little bit. By no means was I a big fist thrower, but it didn't faze me. You go to a Cleveland Browns game, 100% there's going to be a fight. It was a hard end of place to live, but Bay Village was soft. It was sheltered. You're talking about me being multicultured, and you're right, I am. But I also grew up around, and dare I say it, all white people, like in my school. Yeah. And looking at my mom was, and still is, an inner city teacher in Cleveland. And I attribute my upbringing and the way that I view people and life and the world on my mom and dad, but also the fact that at a really young age, I was playing sports. And I played a lot of basketball where I would be the only white guy there, you know, and I got to see and appreciate people for who they are, not what they look like, not what their religion is, not any of the garbage that goes on in the world today, or the world even back then, you know, but that goes on. So I think I was lucky as well that I was gifted in sports to be able to be given those opportunities. You know, I was traveling from a young age, and then my mom and dad would drive me fly me wherever. And they didn't have a lot of money. You know, they would give everything to my sister and myself to try to have us do our activities. And that's really where my mind was able to expand, to be honest with you. Cause if I was just in Bay Village and going back to how I saw like the Northern English, if you don't get to see and experience things from outside, it's very different to have a different view of life. And we're generally, you know, we talk about race, kick racism out of football. What can athletes do? What can soccer do? We can do a little bit. And I sincerely mean that it's a little bit, because most all of that education is done inside your house, you know, or with your real tight, close friends. You're not born a racist. You're taught it. There's three sections of Ohio, really. You have your Cleveland, which is on Lake Erie. Like, in there's certain parts, it's hard. A lot of good athletes, a lot of good business men and women. More of an East Coast feel to it than Midwest. Then you go to Columbus, and it's now a bit more cosmopolitan. But when I was growing up, it very much cornfields, very Midwestern feel to it. One little river, not much water. And then you have Cincinnati, which is right on the border of Kentucky. And the reason I'm telling you this, because there's another thing that molded my life, is one of the ends of the Underground Railroad during the Civil War was Oberlin, which is right by Cleveland. When you got into Oberlin city limits, you were free. You could go to school, you could work, whatever. So I grew up around that mindset, the liberal. It's one of, if you Googled Oberlin College, I think it's still deemed today as the most liberal or one of the most liberal colleges in the United States, probably in the world. And I used to play, they had an outdoor ice hockey rink. I used to go out there all the time. It was probably about a 20-minute drive from my house. So I was also raised in knowing that. So it was in no like a big epiphany. It just was what it was. It wasn't like I can't believe it or I can believe it. It's just how it was. So I consider myself really lucky, like growing up around mainly all white people, but then having the sports, having the history of what Cleveland was, having the history during the Prohibition, learning about my grandfather actually did some stuff during Prohibition, and so the stories that I had.
This is not a euphemism-free podcast, but you can't dangle did some stuff and stories. I'd love to have one granddad story.
Oh, yeah, one granddad story was this. So he worked a multitude of jobs. You know, he was a handyman. Like, it could do things, but he was very well respected. And he grew up at a time where he needed to be hard. So he could look after himself, of course. And like, if you just shook his hands alone, thick and leathered, and they never told me like what he delivered, but he had delivered something for not the police side of town in Cleveland. And, there were speakeasies all over the place. Okay. And so there is a well-known speakeasy. Well, I mean, when I was growing up, obviously you could drink alcohol, but and they turned it into a restaurant. But the place was called White Oak, and there was a separate building that was now non-attached from the new restaurant, and they kept it there because of the history of it. And you can still see the door. And my grandmother, when my grandfather passed away, my grandmother took me there. And you said, you see this door right here. And I said, yeah. She goes, this is where Howard was his name. This is where Howard and I used to come to drink during Prohibition. I went, how? And they said, well, do you notice on the front, it's just brick. And I said, yeah. I said, yeah. She said, well, if you go around the side, and I followed her, we used to knock on this door and the little thing would slide, and it's the speakeasy. And they would either see us, but Howard had to give them a number or a code. I was never allowed to hear it. I was always stood back.
This is your grandmother. This is your grandmother had to stand back.
Yeah.
And often, in case there was a problem, they'd also, you know, I want a cup of coffee or whatever. It was all coded, all hidden, because it was fully illegal to drink. The speakeasies got raided by Elliot Ness's of this world, maybe Elliot Ness's deputies, etc. What a culture. What an amazing culture.
Before the rest of this big interview, I'd like to tell you that our entire archive of audio and video content is now on our new YouTube channel. We've begun filming all of our interviews, and there are already loads of clips with guests, including Rio Ferdinand, Connor Cody, Brendan Rodgers, and Jamie Carragher, plus full interviews for you to watch and to share. Please do share with friends. Go to YouTube and search Graham Hunter, or click on the link in the show notes to this episode and become a subscriber. I honestly think you'll enjoy it. Thanks.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If there's one thing that my family and friends know me for, it's being an amazing gift giver. I owe it all to Celebrations Passport from 1-800-Flowers.com, my one-stop shopping site that has amazing gifts for every occasion. With Celebrations Passport, I get free shipping on thousands of amazing gifts. And the more gifts I give, the more perks and rewards I earn. To learn more and take your gift giving to the next level, Visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Elliot Ness wasn't a big part of Bay Village and growing up, you know, and I'm not even sure like how big he was on the force in Cleveland. I have no idea. I don't know if the film The Untouchables embellished things or, you know, blew it up with Elliot Ness per se. I'm not sure, but I do know that he had the house on Lake Road in Bay Village. And then the other thing in Bay Village that happened that molded who we were was the Sam Shepard case.
Yeah, mid-50s, I guess. Murder case?
Murdered his wife, I believe. So whenever you were in law school or doing like any kind of pre-law or anything like that in high school and then going into your universities, the Sam Shepard case was big. Now, I didn't go into law, so I don't know why, but something happened and it came up almost every year from the time I was like fifth grade up until I graduated, so like seven straight years, there would be at least like a week of something on the Sam Shepard case in school. And you would see his house. There's a plaque on it. I mean, it was remarkable.
It's a beautiful answer that I hope will help people understand you and your later strength and your decisions and your character. And maybe it'll encourage some people to go visit Ohio. I know I will go. I've never been on Lake Erie, but I will go. We haven't got time to talk about it, but Ohio also to me means Dean Martin, up there with one of my favourite singers of all time, and quite a character too. I think this has helped bridge into something that we needed to ask you, obviously, and which our sponsors, 365, has asked us to. They've just sent in the question, what was it like being a young goalkeeper in the Turkish Super League? And I'm interested because we can't spend, you know, you've achieved so much. And also, I want to go into depth about your position, your playing of that position, your psychology, that's coming. But when you go to Galatasaray, there's so much background about where you've been. You've been, I hate to use the word, but you've used it before. And when you went to Promo Sport, you went, this is for the one time in my life where I'm not owned by somebody. Your registration has been owned by clubs, but you were owned by Milan Mandarić, which is just extraordinary. You struck one of the... There wouldn't have been many people globally in that year who struck a better deal than you did with Milan Mandarić. And to go to Galatasaray, to see what you saw, to experience what you experienced, to learn, if I'm not wrong, to learn a bit of... You were reasonably comfortable in Turkish, at least at that time. And to culminate in the cup final, now I understand how a youngish Brad Fiedler coped with all of that.
I love change in my sporting life and business life. And when I mean change, opportunities, I love seeing new things. You know, I like to have stability for my children, but I like change and, you know, and even giving them things to see and opening their eyes. I had a terrible time of getting a work permit. You know, I kept having all these wonderful clubs and head coaches scout me and sign me, sign contracts, and have the permit denied. Graham Souness was one who tried to sign me when he was at Liverpool. It was at the time that we were about to try to go into contract, he went into the hospital, and then shortly after that, he left his position was fired at Liverpool. Roy Evans had taken over, and we had restarted the communication. But at that time, I had had to go, and I had signed for Newcastle and could get a work permit. Went to Brøndby for a short spell while I was trying to figure out things. And then Graham took the job at Galatasaray. And I knew Galatasaray by name. Had never been to Turkey before. And I was training. I was in Denmark training with Viborg at the time, just to stay fit, because a friend of mine, Mike Burns, who was with the national team, had just signed a contract there. So once I was out there, I got the call from Paul Stretford, who was my agent at the time, and he said, apparently, as it turns out, well, the first goalkeeper, Galatasaray, broke his arm, but Graham wasn't really, you know, he didn't really like him all that much anyways. And there was another goalkeeper who was a younger one, and the board kept telling him he was the guy, and he made a mistake in one of the preseason games. But but I think against Beşiktaş or Fenerbahce, but one of the big games. But before the season started, and he went over to the post, and the post at the old Ali Sami Yen were solid, and he headbutted it. He was like bleeding, and I mean, I'm pretty sure that back then, I mean, there was no concussion test or anything, but he was more than likely concussed himself. So Graham was like, how can I have this guy? And you can only have three foreigners, you know, and realistically, if you go in as a foreign coach, you don't want to spend one of your foreign spots on a goalkeeper if you can help it. But he got in a position where he had Hakan Şükür, Dean Saunders was there. Barry Venison was there at the time, but then Barry left shortly after and Uli Van Gogh came in. And we had like two guys, Burak Elmas, Arif, Swat, Little Okan, who played at AC Milan for a time. Like these were the national team players that were just qualifying for the Euros for the first time. So we had a lot of really top quality Turkish national team players. So he was able to use one of the foreign spots on me, and we went in and we stayed like we were all living at the Pullout Renaissance Hotel when we first signed contracts. I came in shortly after Dean, Graham, and those. You know, I was probably a month later because they had started the preseason, and I didn't come in until after the one game or two games into the season. And I remember there's all this fanfare, and I didn't speak a word of Turkish, obviously, at the time. But I mean, right when I landed, and it was just me, I flew in from Denmark. I have all, you know, all these bags, and I'm bringing in, and nobody told me at the time that I needed exact change for the visa to get into Turkey. And I didn't even have a mobile phone then. You know, this is going back then. So it wasn't like texts or anything. It's like if they sent the email, then, and I got it before I had left, but then, you know, and it was all that AOL, you know, that, you know, you've got mail and all that, you know, it was back during that time. Yeah. So I land and I have credit cards and I have a couple $100 bills. And I get there and no Turkish, only English. And I look and the other side of customs, it's glass. And I just see, well, okay, I'll exaggerate now, what seemed like, you know, 5,000 people, but, you know, a few hundred people, but like all lined up and with all these cameras and out there. And I didn't, you know, I was like, no, that's not for me. I mean, I haven't even signed my contract yet, you know? And so, and plus it was about 1 o'clock in the morning. It was a late flight. They would not let me in. And I was like, and I went, no, and I had money, but I couldn't understand that they were saying, like, they were being kind. They were like, don't give me that because it's too much. And they were saying, like, do you have, they kept saying Arkadaş, which is friend. But I didn't know what it meant. And then finally, I see Paul Stretford there at the window. He's looking at me like, you didn't bring any money? And I was like, no, I brought money. But, you know, anyway, so I get in. And right when I came through, I mean, the paparazzi, it's just and on you. And, you know, and from that point on, like somebody else had to get the bags and you're you know, straight into a car and, you know, straight to the Pullout Renaissance Hotel where they wouldn't let anyone else in. And then you go into sign your contract the next day in the media. I mean, it's just what was remarkable for me was I knew Liverpool was a massive club because it was Liverpool, and we went through the history of why I supported them. And I got, by this time, I knew a lot about Liverpool and the history. You know, Man United's a big club. You hear that Galatasaray is a big club. You don't realize how big until you're there. And it is enormous. It doesn't have the quality of history of a Barcelona, of a Real Madrid, of the Man Uniteds, but it's got some deep history.
It's life and death to the fans, isn't it? Life and death to the fans.
It really is. You know, as a journalist over there, what you'd find remarkable is that I used to ask why there's so many pictures, and they said, well, there's a vast majority of the population that won't be able to read if we write too much. So we try to fill the papers with as much pictures of you guys as possible. And they weren't like pictures with us at a store. They were like on the training ground. open trainings most all the time. And if you didn't do that, you would have some issues with the supporters clubs and things of that nature. They lived it. But so I hadn't even signed the contract yet, and they're trying to follow me in the hotel everywhere I went, and people are sneaking through security and trying to see what you're doing, even if you're just sitting by the pool, if you're going to the gym, and in England, and in Denmark, the two places I had been prior to that, people want to know who you are. They will ask you for the odd photo, and they'll ask you for an autograph. But unless you're the Beckham or the Ronaldo, you can live your life.
There's a sense of respect about personal space, isn't there?
Yeah, there really is. And I also think the education level of, not school education, the football education of the supporters in England is enormous. I really do. I think they appreciate certain things. And one of the other things they appreciate is to allow you to go to Tesco and shop on your own.
Yeah.
they'll give you that in Turkey. No way. If you went out of the house, expect to be mobbed, and not in a bad way. I really like the people and the culture in Turkey. But I think the Turkish players, especially the ones that spoke a bit of English, very interested to hear what an American thought about Turkey.
Really?
Do you like it here? Do you like it? What do you think? Is it okay?
That was them wanting reinforcement because they're enormously proud of their country, their culture, their history.
And curious what the rest of the world thought about them.
You already knew a little bit about the Ottoman Empire. You'd a smattering of knowledge of the country's background.
Yeah, I did, because I was a history major at UCLA, and I had studied that a bit. But there's a difference of studying in a book and meeting people. My neighbor that lived upstairs, the first time they had two children, and the daughter, remember when we first met, needed to be covered around me. And then after he got to know me, didn't, and I found it remarkable, but in a really good way. Take this young kid out of Ohio, who had a lot of culture and sport and some with Civil War history. Go out to LA into a melting pot of everything and everybody, and a huge Spanish speaking culture out in LA that I'd never been around. And then I'm getting touted to get over to England, which is very much more similar to Cleveland. And then I find myself in Turkey and never lived around a Muslim culture in my life. And I guess the biggest thing I learned about it, Graham, was that we all live in our own propaganda. That's what I learned straight away. So I was basically, taught growing up that the Russians were against us, Iran and Iraq was against us, and the truth of the matter is, the governments have issues. Individual people, I don't have a problem with anyone that's Russian. I never had a problem with anyone from Iran or Iraq. That's reality of the situation. So when I was over in learning about Muslim cultures and the different factions and who is portrayed as good and bad, it was remarkable, because it'd be like I'd then watch maybe CNN. It's completely different to what Al Jazeera, and I'm actually living where they're reporting on it. And I know that what Al Jazeera is saying is correct, and what CNN is saying is incorrect.
You struck up a chord with me because, without we don't need to, we won't get massively involved in Muslim culture. But when you see something as simple as there was a family upstairs, there was a young girl. Initially, when they didn't know me, she was covered. When they got to know me and trusted me, that wasn't an issue. She didn't have to. If you say that as simply as that, there's a reasonably strong degree of logic to that. That's fine as a concept. I remember coincidentally going to Qatar to interview Xavi.
and arriving at 3 a.m, taking a lot of time to get through the airport, getting to bed in the hotel, to be woken to the call to prayer, by the call to prayer, which I'd never heard in my life. Even in London, I hadn't lived near enough a mosque, but the mosque was right next to my window, I think, to the extent you could open it and look out, and maybe it was 5 a.m. I've just got to sleep. We've got work today. But you open the window, and the mosque is so full that there are dozens and dozens of people kneeling down in prayer in the pavement outside. They're up at 5 a.m. They must have been up at 4 to be there. That level of devotion, that level of sacrifice, if you don't at least want to understand it, or if it doesn't generate respect in you immediately just for the basic act of how much they're putting into it, then I think you're a pretty shallow person. But whatever conclusions you wish to draw, you don't even get these pictures in your mind until you move, until you look, until you're open enough to go, well, I'd like to know a little bit more.
We had a training session. I can't remember why, but it either had to be pushed up or pushed back. And I remember Ahmed, one of the assistant coaches and translators, said, Graham, that's during prayer time. And Graham said, I know I'm not doing it to be disrespectful. And Ahmed said, well, you know, some of the players may need to go out of training at the time, you know, and Graham, very respectful, of course, you know, Graham, a very intelligent man, and right, you know, when the call to prayer was coming, I think 8 or 9 players went over and did, you know, what I was curious about, and, you know, I won't name names at the time because some people will know him, but I said, so, like, why is that group praying and you're not? And that's where, you know, well, there's different levels of faith, you know, fantastic. You know, and all of it was learning when they, is it a sheep or a goat they sacrifice?
I think it's a goat, by legend at least. I think it's a goat.
It happened in front of me. It was Boulant, the captain, and then the goalkeeper. We were playing at Denizlispor, I believe it was, and they did it. And, you know, and the Turkish players would dip down and, you know, dip their hand in the blood and put it either on their head, some of it on the boots and things like that. And it was for luck. You wouldn't see that in the United States. The way I view all that is how lucky am I to see it. I think it's very close-minded to be, what are you doing? You know, like it's that's their culture. I tell you how I always viewed it. Even when I went out to LA, I view other people's states, other people's cities, other people's towns, other people's countries as for me to go and adapt to them, not the other way around. And I think that's one of the reasons why I found it so, found my time in the UK so endearing with the fans of the clubs that I was at, because I always tried to engulf myself in their culture and try to acclimatize as best I can. That's why I think the Galatasaray fans, still today when I walk around places, will remember me. And I mean, I'm 50 now. I mean, how can you remember me? I played there in 1996, I think it was.
Football fans, once we fall in love, Brad, that's it, man. That's it.
You know, that's the best way to put it. And I think what somebody asked me a long time ago, why do I think English players have a hard time going abroad? So, you know, I think David Beckham was a tremendous success, but he's more of a global pop star, if you like. And then with his, you know, with he and Victoria, they were a different machine going outside. Steve McManaman was a friend of mine when he went to Spain. You know, that took some adapting. It really did. I was surprised in knowing Gareth Bale as well as I do. I was surprised, take the language side out of it, but I was surprised that he liked Madrid so much. Not Real Madrid, of course. I mean, how can you not like the club? But I was surprised that when he went outside the UK, like that he would even consider settling there at some stage in his life. You know, that surprised me, because the English players generally don't like going out and then adapting to somebody else's culture.
We don't mind being challenged on the pitch. We don't mind being bawled out by the coach. We don't mind if it becomes physical. We don't mind being told you're not going to make it.
I cherish the fact that I've lived abroad, but many of them don't like being challenged culturally. They don't like being told you're going to go outside a certain comfort zone, which you talk, it's a theme that equates to the people you saw in the north who love to live in their little neighbourhood, their village, keep the routines, know this guy, know the family, down the pub. Why we're creatures of routine? Why we're scared to be... there's this perception amongst Brits that we'll be humiliated if we get a phrase wrong and we... Oh, I don't like the taste of that. I don't understand it, but it's a real theme.
Pre-season trip when I was with Blackburn to... we were in Washington, D.C. We're staying at the Ritz-Carlton in Georgetown. Great training pitches. Beautiful hotel. Wake up in the morning... we get down to breakfast, and then one of the lads says to me, "You know, Brad, can you see if they have any English breakfast tea?" And I look at him, and I went, "They do speak English here." He goes, "Yeah, but you're American. Can you see?" So the fella's like standing right there. So it's like I just shouted across the room. I was like, "Excuse me, do you have English breakfast tea?" And they said, "No, we have Lipton." The American. And they actually said, "Oh, this place is shit." I'm like, we are at a Ritz-Carlton in Georgetown in D.C. on preseason. Beautiful. You have a Premier League contract and you can't get English breakfast tea and this place is shit. Like, I couldn't get my head around it.
Thank you for listening to The Big Interview. It's produced by me, which sounds egotistical, but it's also true, Graham Hunter, and Back Page. Our music is by Beer Jacket, who else? Editing by Charlie McGarry. Thank you to our hosts at Acast and our loyal sponsors at Bet365. We're also supported by our socios. Find out how to become a socio, how to support us, at patreon.com/Graham Hunter. Here endeth the lesson.
1-800-Flowers.com is more than your birthday, anniversary, or just because gift-giving destination. We put our hearts into everything we do to help you celebrate all life's special occasions with friends and family. From our farmers and bakers, florists and makers, everything from 1-800-Flowers is made with love every step of the way, because we know that nothing is more important than delivering a smile. To learn more, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.